welcome to part two of the Movie Geeks United countdown of our five favorite directors. Okay, so last night we left off with my last choice, which was David Lynch. And you know what that means.
Yeah.
Jerry's next.
Oh, I thought you were going to play the music from Dune. Okay. I was waiting for that, so I'm next. Okay, well, the next three, we just get bigger and bigger. And I'm going to go with Sam Peckinpah. And I have a confession to make about the everyone that's following this, including this one. These are all movies that I watch in the theater in re-releases, or like anniversary or director's cuts, and that would be like the Wild Bunch when that came out in 1995, I believe was the director's cut, restored version.
Uh-huh.
And right. I think that just cemented the Wild Bunch as my favorite film of all time. And I mean, there are other, I mean, I like Cross of Iron a lot. I'll say I really enjoy Cross of Iron, and actually my favorite part of Cross of Iron is the closing, the way the credits start at the end. I just think that's a fascinating sequence. You know, we talk about De Palma and his great sequences, and there are a lot of them, obviously. You can talk about them. But I just love the you talked about opening credits last night, but I love the closing credits of Cross of Iron. That was the first thing about that movie that really just struck me.
When you look at the credit sequence to The Wild Bunch, that is one of the most insanely great credit sequences ever.
Oh, yeah.
It gets you into the movie, but it also lets you know so much of the past.
Oh, yeah. Yet. What I like, I guess, about The Wild Bunch, you see it with his other films. You see it with, I think to a lesser extent, with The Killer Elite, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, and even The Getaway, and what's the one with the rodeo one with Steve McQueen, Junior Bonner?
Oh, yeah, Junior Bonner.
You see it with that. You see it with Major Dundee. You see it with about... They're all about people who, men who have outlived their times. I don't think that's expressed better than in The Wild Bunch. There is this, almost this pathetic quality of loyalty that they have to each other, that they have to no one else. At the end when Pike says, let's go, that's just quite a line right there, and it's like, why the hell not? And you know that these men are going to die.
Do you remember that moment when you were sitting there watching in the theater? As I do, I remember this. I remember this so vividly. In 1995, watching it on the big screen for the first time, and I've only seen it maybe twice since on the big screen. That moment where he says, let's go, and William Holden's blue eyes piercing through the screen, through that Lucian Ballard cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable.
Amazing.
An unforgettable moment.
Yeah, and it's another thing about, we always talk about Henry Fonda playing against type in Once Upon a Time in the West, or like Gregory Peck in Voice from Brazil, and even Denzel Washington, Training Day. Let's not forget, at the time, William Holden was massively playing against type with this movie. I mean, you could say in The Bridge on the River Kwai that he's sort of, but he's still like a good guy.
Heroic,
he's nihilistic.
You know?
He's nihilistic compared to Jack Hawkins and, Alec Guinness.
Yeah.
There's an argument to be made that both of them are just as far gone, in especially Alec Guinness. But going back to William Holden, remember, what did he tell the guy? If they move, kill them. Remember in the beginning, if they move,
which eventually became the title for the, great, biography.
David Weddle's biography, which I read that biography, and I read another one, Savage Cinema, and I'm very sorry to say I never read Bloody Sam.
Yeah.
I never read that one. I'm very sorry.
If they move, kill them, if I was going to look at all three of those titles, I was going to go, if they move, kill them. That's the one I'm reading.
yeah, no, that's it's a great, It's a great biography, and it's one a lot of stuff I did not know. I did not know that I don't know if beg is the right word, but he had to get second unit work, I think, on the movie Jinx, the Bette Midler movie that I think Robert Aldrich directed. And that and he did such a good job on that. I think they gave him the Osterman Weekend. Is the if I'm not mistaken,
right,
that's the last film he directed.
At that time, he was pretty eaten up with not only alcoholism but with cocaine addiction. So.
I think that's evident on Convoy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was evident. I mean, no joke. I mean, he really and according to that book, if I'm not mistaken, he was. I mean, he may have had something a little bit to drink or something, but he was mostly sober during the making of The Wild Bunch. He was not. I mean,
I think that shows in the movie.
Oh,
the movie is incredibly precise.
Yeah, but that's just an incredible movie. I remember the first time watching that with my mom, and that shootout. The only thing at the time that compared to that would be the Scarface shootout, which is over. I mean, let me put it. Those movies, you know, both of these movies, I guess by today's standards, are pretty tame. I even think that with The Wild Bunch, there's probably a just, you know, younger.
I don't feel that way.
I feel
quite differently about that. I feel like The Wild Bunch has retained. The violence in The Wild Bunch has retained its quality of shot.
Yeah.
But
I think the younger generation, unfortunately, he doesn't see that. But I don't think it's him at all. I still get chills. I get chills when they, you know, they're walking in and they throw Angel's body to them, and you just know, oh, God, this is, oh, no. It's all going down, and it's one of the great climaxes. But, I mean, there are other. The other thing that's fascinating is the performances he got out of actors, especially Warren Oates. Just magnificent performances.
And by the way, could I remind you? You haven't mentioned this movie, and this is very necessary to mention. Ride the High.
No, that's a great.
That is so much a precursor. I mean, I feel like that's just sort of a twin movie to The Wild Bunch in a lot of ways.
Let me ask you this. Would you say that was a new kind of Western when it came out?
It wasn't recognized as such, and it actually didn't come to fruition until probably until the mid-60s, so it was ahead of its time. And basically, Ride the High Country was kind of a B movie, really. You know, even though it had Joel McRae and Randolph Scott in it, R.G. Armstrong and so many other people that you know figured later on in Sam Peckinpah's career as actors, it wasn't a movie that was recognized as. Anything when it came out.
That's a great cast. It's a great cast you mentioned. It's such an incredible cast. It always struck me. It's a great documentary about Warren Oates on the Cockfighter DVD. And besides the wonderful, obviously, biography that we interviewed the author, Susan Campos, right? And a wonderful biography. Just absolutely wonderful. But Warren Oates is. Fascinating actor. Just very, very rich life. And you see that in Peckinpah's films and in other films, obviously. Another great film is that I like Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid.
Yes,
God, I haven't seen that in a long time either.
But the director's cut of that is really quite good, too. I mean, that's like one of the great director's cuts. And again, you know, I mean, an amazing amalgamation of actors in it. You know, from non-actors like Bob Dylan, of course, but also
Bob Dylan.
You know,
an incredible
you know, supporting performance by Flynn Pickens and Katie Girardeau.
He got great performances out of Pickens, also in that little bit in the original Getaway.
Yes.
Well, you mentioned Warren Oates, and to go back to him for a little bit, I think what's so effective about Warren Oates in the Peckinpah films. Especially is the idea that he does come across as a man as an authentic person, like a man that has lived a lot of life, and you can see that life in the crinkles of his face.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel the same sense of authenticity from Sam Peckinpah.
Yeah.
I mean, when I think about Sam Peckinpah, a couple of things come to mind. I always kind of couple him with the Hal Ashby, because
mm-hmm.
Ashby was another person that lived hard, and he paid the price, both in
mm-hmm.
terms of his health and in terms of the latter part of his career.
Yeah, right.
And they're
almost twins in some ways, you know.
Yeah.
That's a good,
yeah.
good point.
But Peckinpah was, Ride the High Country, that was heralded overseas big time. And,
mm-hmm.
and he was already kind of hailed as the successor to John Ford, based on that movie.
Right.
But the Wild, obviously the main legacy of a Sam Peckinpah is the way he dealt with violence. The kind of balletic nature of his violence.
Kurosawa.
Yeah. I mean, there is Kurosawa in there, but I would venture to say you wouldn't have the John Woo we know of today without a Peckinpah.
Oh, no, you wouldn't have.
Well, even going so far as to say, you know, even Tarantino, for instance, you know, I mean,
yeah,
like,
you know, he loved Peckinpah. I mean, they both.
I just want to bring up something here. This is important. You know, Peckinpah actually put that violence in as a reaction to the bloodless violence that was in so many Westerns for so many years,
mm-hmm.
where someone was shot and they just fell down. There wasn't even a bullet hole or whatever. So they were all right, whatever, you know. But he said, this isn't what violence is. Violence is bloody, it's messy, it's horrific.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. But the problem I see from the people who've taken influence from Peckinpah is that I don't really feel that same sense. I don't feel that Tarantino, for instance, feels that way. You know, I mean,
no,
I think that's a very good point. Violence as being a source of entertainment, and it can be, but.
You bring up a good point. That's an excellent point, an excellent observation. There's a whole generation of filmmakers and that, how shall I say it, maybe they're not even, you know, more influenced by video games than even movies these days. You know, there's almost a sense that, you know, what's that great scene in Fearless where the kids are playing the video game and Jeff Bridges goes and he says, you don't get another life. When you die, you die. You don't, you know, he rips the console out of their hands. I guess it's an old Nintendo or something, because the movie was 93, if I'm not, 92 or 93, or 94
right.
even, I'm not. And I just remember that scene, because you don't get three lives, you get one life, that's it. I always thought that was a great indictment of violence, too.
Of the violence, I mean, when I talk about John Woo taking cues from him, I mean, purely from a stylistic standpoint, purely from the point of view of that kind of the slow motion ballet of violence. But there is a caution when it comes to depicting screen violence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Kubrick brought it up when he was doing an interview for Full Metal Jacket. They asked him, you know, how do you portray the horrors of war when at the same time just the act of seeing war on screen, you know, the horrific kind of beauty of the explosions and the adrenaline and the excitement that's kind of inescapable. I mean, how do you balance that? I mean, that's kind of a dichotomy. And he says, yeah, I mean, you really can't. Because, you could see the punishment of brutality and the lasting effects of it, the ugliness of it. But at the same time, when you're dealing with an action scene or a scene of violence, it's inherently exciting. I mean, it pumps you up a bit. I mean, just by its very nature.
So it's really left to the viewer to really provide the perspective as to whether it's something that's merely entertaining or whether it's something cautionary.
I mean, Straw Dogs is...
that's another, I didn't even bring that up. It's a disturbing film. I like it. But that's what the violence is, I think, what Dean's talking about, maybe more so.
You're thinking, okay, he's finally going to explode. It's about time in one sense. Where your mind is at.
Give them Niles, David.
They'll beat him to death.
I don't care. Get him out!
You really don't care, do you?
No, I don't.
I care. This is where I live. This is me. I will not allow violence against this house. No way.
And Straw Dogs is one of his most morally ambiguous films. And I also think about Pauline Kael when I think of Peckinpah. Because Kael loved Peckinpah. Even when she disliked his movies, it was, you know, she always kind of came out with excuses for him. I mean, she thought that Straw Dogs was particularly nihilistic. But she still felt Peckinpah's greatness in that film. And they had this back and forth correspondence. I mean, they really genuinely liked each other.
Let me ask you a question, and I know we talked about it when the remake came out, and I like Rod Laurie a lot, but I think Rod Laurie is sort of, obviously I prefer the Peckinpah version, but I almost think he missed the point of the original at times in the remake.
I thought he dropped the ball.
And
I guess I revealed as much to him on my Facebook and to his displeasure. The thing that he missed more than anything in his version of Straw Dogs was that ambiguity. Mm-hmm. And the rape scene is the prime example. I mean, there's no questioning. In Peckinpah's original, what makes that scene in particular so incendiary is the idea that you think maybe she wanted it. That's a really, like, unpopular point of view.
Right, no, it is. You're absolutely right. That's
Rod
the Todd Aiken school of thought.
Rod Laurie took the exact opposite approach. I mean, it was obvious that that was a horrific experience for her.
Right.
And so, I mean, you take the fire and the controversy out of the most incendiary scene in Straw Dogs.
Right.
Why are you bothering to remake it?
He was just reacting. Unfortunately for him, you know, to choose to make Straw Dogs, you have to approach that scene in such a way that you're really, frankly, these days, it's absolutely taboo to approach that scene. If he had gone out and just redone it, he's been raked over the coals, which, by the way, is not our fault, and it's only his fault or the movie company's fault in actually choosing to remake Straw Dogs.
Right.
So you don't have to remake Straw Dogs. No one said you had to do it.
Right.
But if you were going to do it correctly.
Yeah, if you're
going to
do it, don't take all the fire out of it. And that's what he did.
That was just because he's reacting to a present day political climate that didn't exist in
reality.
I don't know if that's the thing, because he seemed to really understand what made Peckinpah's version great, and he seemed to understand why it was as controversial as it was.
It's hard to make the original so much.
It's easy to say that you understand the movie, the original film, but it's more difficult to say, yes, I followed the original movie, its intent, to the letter.
Well, I know what his point was in remaking it, and he's made it very clear. Peckinpah's version is nihilistic. Rod Laurie is a humanist. He wanted to approach Straw Dogs from that point of view, to which my main response is, why?
Why make a real humanist movie that doesn't have any violence in it whatsoever?
Yeah. It's a good choice, and, you know, it's a filmmaker that we're still talking about. I mean, Tony Scott died last month, but one of his next projects was a remake of The Wild Bunch. If not The Wild Bunch, well, we got the Straw Dogs remake. Is there any other movie in his resume that you think people will eventually be salivating to do a remake of?
Well, I am curious. It's his worst movie, and it's dated by today's standards, but so is The Bourne Identity. I'd like to see someone take another stab at the Osterman Weekend.
Yeah.
I think that you can't, because if you remade The Bourne Identity as it was written, there was no way to do that. Well, let's also talk about what all those people involved with all four movies did is incredible, because they did take the source material and took out, how should we say, just got rid of all the fat. Because remember, those were all made, the original three books were made in the ABC miniseries of the week or whatever, with I think Richard Chamberlain played Jason Bourne?
Yeah.
Those are all, like Robert Ludlum used to be a staple for ABC. You know, we're going to make a miniseries out of everything he writes, and that's a lot of money right there. So I would like to see someone try to actually update the Osterman Weekend, and I wouldn't mind seeing that. Now, I don't know if you want, just because I think remakes are good, especially if you, let's go after something that didn't work and try to make it better.
Yeah.
Let's improve upon it. I don't know. I mean, look, everything is being remade. So, like, you know, I remember when they announced plans to remake The Wild Bunch, you're just sort of, okay, this was going to happen. There's nothing you can do about it. It's unavoidable.
Mm.
So we'll see if that ever, you know, comes. But I'd welcome someone to take another stab at the Osterman Weekend. Maybe even get Rutger Hauer to come back.
I'd be very interested to see, because I feel like there's not enough movies today about older people. I think they'll like people who are over 70 or 60 or whatever are just kind of thrown on the scrap heap.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly in movies, you know, in movies they're really mainly there to be fathers or mothers or to be killed or to be demeaned in some way. I'd be very interested to see even though the original is a great movie, Ride the High Country could be a great remake. I think that it could be opened up a little bit more. It could be made a tiny bit more realistic, a little bit closer to, present day filmic pace.
I think
it could be a great, unlike Wild Bunch, which, you know, I suspect that if they do Wild Bunch, they'll just put a whole bunch of 40-year-old guys in it. No, I don't want to see a whole bunch of 40-year-old guys in the Wild Bunch. I want to see a bunch of 60, 70-year-old guys in the Wild Bunch.
Well, you
and
have
the same
that,
thing
then.
Goes for... Same thing goes for Ride the High Country. I want to see two 75-year-old dudes up on horses riding the High Country.
You sort of have that. I mean, the answer to that, to a much lesser extent, is the two Expendable movies. That's the Hollywood's idea of
even in that, you have to admit that those exist in order to sort of laugh at these 60, 70-year-old guys, 50,
70-year-old
guys.
We're
there to laugh at them. It's ridiculous that these 70-year-old guys are out there carrying 70-pound machine guns or whatever they're doing. Come on. It's there to be laughed at. I don't want a movie to laugh at it. I want a movie
like,
that tells the real truth, just like sort of like Unforgiven did.
And there was no empty chair in that. Horrible. But what about Tommy Lee Jones in No Country for Old Men, though? That's a great
performance.
That's
of,
true.
I mean, that's true.
No,
that,
I mean,
that last scene is haunting. That last scene where he talks about the dream is chilling. Gives me chills to this day.
No question about it. And that is what that movie is about. That movie is sort of the natural sort of progression of something like The Wild Bunch or Ride the High Country has already put forth. It's like, this is a time, your time is over now because you just can't conceive of what's ahead of you.
Well, right. And they're trapped in a way, you know, it's a world that they don't understand.
I mean, when that scene, when they see the car, when they see the car, the first time they see a car in the Mexican town.
Oh, yeah.
Look,
yeah.
That's, you know, they're just like, what? What is that?
Okay, so Dean, your next choice.
Oh, my next choice. This is so difficult. What a difficult job this is, coming out with these. Oh, boy. I tell you what. All right. Well, and I should make the public know that we do not know what each other, what all of us are going to bring out here. We have no idea what our choices are. So in that, I'm holding two aside right now, and I'm going right now for my present day favorite filmmaker who's alive and living and working still.
He's alive and living? Well,
yes, he's alive and living.
There is a difference.
Still,
I guess
well,
there is.
You could
be
alive.
I'm alive.
You could be alive.
Really
you could
living.
Be alive, and you could be alive and
I get it.
He's alive and working today still. He's been working since 1971. He's a British filmmaker. His name is Michael Lee. I consider him the greatest movie maker working today. Well, the first time I saw a Mike Lee movie was in 1990. It was a movie called Life is Sweet. Life is Sweet is a difficult movie to find these days. It's especially in America, at least. I don't believe that it's been released on DVD. It was released on VHS. I still have my VHS copy of it. And I actually had it signed by Mike Lee when I actually met him at the New York Film Festival a couple of years ago, which was a mind-blowing experience. Life is Sweet was the first movie that I ever saw by him, and it completely took me by surprise. It was in 1990, and it actually won that year. It won the Best Picture Award from the National Society of Film Critics, which is actually kind of the most maverick kind of film critic society that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
And they not only gave it Best Picture, but they gave it Best Actress for Alison Steadman, who plays the mother in the film, and also Best Supporting Actress to Jane Horrocks, who plays one of her twin daughters in the film. And I have to say, when I saw this movie, I had no idea what the flavor of life was in one of the biggest cities in the world, London. You know, that flavor of life that that just middle-class people were living, or even lower-class people were living. But that movie was my sort of entry point into Mike Lee's worldview. And this worldview is an incredibly compassionate, realistic worldview in which he has so much love for every single one of his characters, even at their most unlovable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'd like to also say that what's interesting about Mike Lee is there is not one major act of violence in any one of his movies.
That's
and
true.
And he has been making movies since 1971 all the way to 2010. They haven't all been feature films. He made a large slate of television movies for the BBC and for Channel 4, you know, kind of beginning in 1973 and moving up until 1985. And then eventually in 1988, he had his breakthrough in the United States with a movie called High Hopes.
That's right.
Which was a movie about sort of kind of burnt out, a lovely couple of burnt out sort of hippies. And, you know, it's so difficult for me to actually sit here and talk about Mike Lee because it's difficult, you know, all I can do is rely on my passion about his movies. If I'm to sit here and tell you about the plot lines in his movies, I'm not going to convince you to go and see the movies because it's going to be some kind of long, you know, twisted sort of thing. I'm not going to be able to convince you. The only way that I can convince people who are not familiar with Mike Lee to go see Mike Lee movies, to check them out wherever you can find them, is that they are incredibly compassionate. They are incredibly, incredibly well acted. They are directed like no other movie is directed out there, with just this sense of absolute realism. There is not one single speck of falseness in any movie he has ever done. Not one single speck of like, yeah, that just seems like a movie construct, or yeah, that wouldn't really happen, or yeah, I just don't get it. No, it's all right there. His movies are funny. They are dramatic. They are shocking. They are real. They are brilliantly filmed. He has a crew that is completely dedicated to him, a crew of he works with the same cinematographer every time. He generally works with the same person who does the score every time. The scores in his movies, you know, it's very interesting. You know, the scores in his movies are just absolutely beautiful. They're sort of like plaintive and sort of like, they're not the kind of score like a John Williams score or something like that. They're just sort of plaintive and they serve a purpose, but they serve a purpose for just the most delicate of moods, you know. And then chiefly among, of course, he's the writer of all of his movies, and then we get into his process. Okay, that's what makes Michael Lee one of the most interesting filmmakers out there, not the most interesting. His process is largely secretive, but it consists of something like this. He has an idea. He has, you know, note cards. He has a sense of what each scene is going to be, what the beginning and the end is going to be, where the major points are. He has this series of note cards. He has a list of characters. He casts the characters through his, you know, I mean, he originally started off in stage in the 60s, maybe even in the late 50s. He was an improv actor himself and was a stage actor himself. And through that, he gained a lot of connections to the British acting, you know, powerhouse that's out there. So casting his movies is not difficult. He just goes to the people that he knows, and there's a lot of people in his movies like Jim Broadbent or Timothy Spall, Ruth Sheen, Leslie Manville, David Tulis, Stephen Ray, on and on. These people pop up in his movies all the time. Why? Because they love working with him. Why do they love working with him? Because this process that he goes through with his note cards, he casts the movie, they get into the movie, they all sit around a table, basically. They improv the scenes under his direction,
mm-hmm.
and then he goes back and constructs the scene out of the improv session, delivers the scenes back to them, and they act them. That's basically it. Nobody else in movies is doing this. Nobody. Nobody in America, nobody's doing it. That's what makes his movies have that unique sense of just, this is absolutely real. It is happening right in front of me. This is a taste of a world that is so well lived in, so well appreciated, that it's impossible for the viewer to ignore its quality. Let's just say this, too, before I end. He doesn't just do this with just, you know, I don't want to just give this sense that all of his movies are bland, you know, sort of like in bland sort of, you know, middle-class worlds, lower-class worlds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's also done movies like Topsy Turvy, which is kind of an epic about,
mm-hmm.
About, you know, the writing of the Mikado by Gilbert and Sullivan, which is kind of his first foray into genre filmmaking in some ways, because it's
mm-hmm.
basically a musical. And then you go to something like Vera Drake, which was his movie about a real-life lady who provided abortions illegally.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, she didn't even know it was illegal in Britain in the 60s and was actually in prison for it.
Right.
But then you've got, you know, to go back to his other movies, you know, you've got Naked with David Tulis. It's like just this sort of incredibly nihilistic hero that we have in front of us. But yet he's funny, and we like him, and we're rooting for him, really. And we understand, and a lot of the stuff he says is true. But it's also sort of the nihilism of a youthful person that hasn't lived enough and learned enough. And then you've got something like Career Girls, which is also like sort of kind of connected to Naked, and it has some similar. Well, it does have, you know, a couple of the characters from Naked. It's kind of a nominal sequel.
Yeah.
But Career Girls, you know, it's just this wonderful movie about how these two girls who were roommates in college meet up 10 years later, and how their lives are completely different, and how they
mm-hmm.
realize they didn't really appreciate each other way back then, but now they do, but it's totally over, you know?
Yeah, I think about that a lot, that film, actually. I think about that film a lot. I actually thought about it this week, Dean, as I was thinking about you and how much you liked Another Year, and I know you like Mike Lee a great deal. There's a scene in Career Girls that I find devastating, where they run into, I guess they went to college with the gentleman, and they thought, I guess he's homeless, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
he's down on his luck.
Yeah, he is.
It's a devastating scene. It was a very emotionally gut-wrenching scene.
Back then they were kind of making fun of him, but they run into him and they realize that they were completely assholes.
right. But it's a devastating scene.
And they realized that they had a moment where they could have done something to, well, if not save him, at least help him, help him along a little bit. But they did nothing. So his movies just absolutely do not spare their main characters one iota. I mean, they will say whether the main character is wrong or right. They, like I said, they're always funny if you're paying attention. And then I think, you know, in that case too, I should say that, you know, I would counsel that if you're watching a Mike Lee movie and you have it on DVD, and I would throw the subtitles on sometimes, if not always, because I think that it would help your, you know, intake of what Lee is saying and his actors are saying. Let me just say, Another Year is a beautiful movie about aging.
Mm-hmm.
It's the perfect movie for Mike Lee. It was made in 2010 for Mike Lee to make at that point in time. But also there was Happy-Go-Lucky, which I find fascinating movie. Happy-Go-Lucky is fascinating because I feel, and I haven't seen him talk about this at all, but I feel that Happy-Go-Lucky was maybe a reaction. Maybe
there might have been somebody who came up to Mike Lee and said, why are your movies always so depressing? Why
mm-hmm.
don't you find
right,
movies
right.
depressing? I find them completely, like, exhilarating. But somebody might come up to him and say, why are your movies always so depressing? And he might go, and I've seen Mike Lee in interviews, like, and he is very, like, frank with interviewers. He's just like, if he doesn't like your question, he'll just tell you. Well, that's a stupid question. I could see Mike Lee going, well, what do you want me to make? You want me to make a movie about somebody that's completely happy all the time? And, yeah, why don't you try that? And he said, okay, I will. So that's what Happy-Go-Lucky is. It's this movie about somebody who's completely happy all the time, even in the face of somebody, as she, you know, she's taking car lessons in that movie. And
right.
And she has that incredibly horrible car and driving instructor.
Eddie Marsden.
By
Eddie
Marsden.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he's crazy in that.
He is. And she is just so giving to him throughout the entire film until you realize that she just can't take it anymore and she has to
mm-hmm.
step up. The smile on her face is just not going to last through this.
I can't believe you're a teacher.
I can't believe they have put you in charge of 40
children.
Took
me by surprise, to be honest.
She's 30.
30. You have no respect for order. You are arrogant, you're disruptive, and you celebrate chaos.
Oh, I slipped through the net, didn't I?
No, you are the net. Believe you me, Poppy, you are the net.
Oh,
okay, we're going to do next left turn. Mirror signal maneuver. Enra Ha. Keep with it, Poppy. Okay.
Oh,
get away from the bend. Get away from the bend. Get away from the bend. Do you remember the pyramid?
Don't remind me.
The pyramid?
Enra.
No. Enra Ha is the eye at the top of the pyramid.
Oh,
I'm
right.
talking about the bottom of the pyramid.
Oh, yeah?
Well, those at the bottom of the pyramid in this world are kept in total ignorance of what those at the top of the pyramid are achieving. Enra Ha.
Where
Enra
are you
ha.
On the pyramid?
Me? I'm outside the pyramid and I'm looking in.
Oh,
but where
you
are you? But where are you? That is more to the point. Where are you and where are your
that
children?
That is the question. Where are we all, eh?
Okay, we're going to do the next left turn. Enra Ha.
Did you like school, Scott?
I'm afraid you didn't agree with me.
Oh, that's a shame.
I mean, you know, Secrets and Lies, and then all the BBC movies, you know, Abigail's Party and Nuts in May and Meantime with Gary Oldman and, I mean...
Tim Roth. Isn't Tim Roth in Meantime?
And Tim Roth as well. I mean, there's just a ridiculous wealth. If you've never seen a Mike Lee movie, you have about 25 great movies and shorts out there. Check it out. It's just an incredible wealth.
He gets nominated. He's been nominated quite a few times for his screenplays. Doesn't
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
he does get the nomination almost
every time nowadays that he comes out
yeah.
with a movie, there's at least a screenplay nomination that comes out of it.
He's won a couple of Palme d'Ors. I mean, he's really revered overseas as well. Okay. Okay, my third selection. Spike Lee. I tend to gravitate towards filmmakers whose works kind of I can feel the passion bleeding from the screen, and that's what I've always said about Spike Lee. He does that for me. There are a few films of his in particular that I adore,
mm-hmm.
Mainly 25th Hour and Summer of Sam. What I admire most about Spike Lee's work is how he's unafraid to work in broad strokes.
Mm-hmm.
And two of the most extraordinary moments of his filmography for me are the endings of Jungle Fever and He Got Game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The ending of Jungle Fever, Wesley Snipes is walking down the street and a prostitute comes up to him and propositions him. And in a very grand gesture, he grabs her and cradles her head against his chest. And the camera swoops down from above and swoops down to his kind of screaming face as if he's crying in pain for this generation of young people that have no hopes. And that's the ending of that movie. And most people that would see that would say, what the hell is that? But it's kind of a culmination of all this bickering and not focusing on the things that really matter in life that dominate that movie. the ending of He Got Game, Denzel Washington in the prison basketball yard, his son on the college court, Denzel throws his basketball over the prison fence and it lands on the basketball court in front of his son, kind of like a passage, a literal passage from father to son. You know, those are exactly the kinds of bold moves that people that are cynical would make fun of. That would think
not me, maybe. I love that ending.
You know those people exist. I mean, they're saying they're sticklers for that's so stupid. How could that could never happen? They don't understand metaphor. They don't understand the power of what movies can do.
Right.
And just those two moments, they epitomize what I love about Spike Lee. There's certain stylistic things that he does. Oliver Stone incorporates this particular technique in some of his films, too, to largely a lesser extent. I call them subliminal cuts. They're kind of like someone will be in the middle of a monologue, and then it will cut to a frame or two of that person, you know, standing in a certain pose, like pondering or something, or He Got Game. There's these sequences of conversation, and then you cut to the son, like, posing with a basketball.
Right.
I'm not sure how else to classify them other than to say they're subliminal cuts that kind of deepen your investment in the mentality of the character.
Mm-hmm.
I love the colors. His bold sense translates to the colors in his films as well. The vibrancy of the performances. I mean, the deep reds and blues of 25th Hour.
Mm-hmm.
The orange kind of hues of He Got Game. And you know, you talk about reds, talk about Do the Right Thing. I mean, something, a movie.
That red wall that those guys are sitting in front of throughout that entire movie is just such a, has literally seared its way into my brain, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And a movie whose thematics deal with a community that's about to boil over on the hottest day of the year, you know, and that's perfectly realized in the visuals. The coolness of A Mo' Better Blues. I adore the sharp editing in his movies.
And the love of music in his movies. I mean,
there is
there's
a big love.
His father is Bill Lee, of course, who does a lot of the scores for his movies. So, you know, the love of the you know, was obviously a lifelong love of music that's been passed down from his father.
And again, with his music, very bold choices. I mean, he in opening He Got Game with Aaron Copland, you know, like a classic Americana score. On the basketball court, you know.
Or, of course, probably the greatest film song that's been written for movies in the past maybe 30 years would be Fight the Power Do the Right Thing.
Yeah.
But he actually played in that movie like 20 times.
That's true.
You never get sick of it.
Fascinating.
Like, It's absolutely a stunning piece of music.
One of the most perfect uses of a popular song I've ever seen is Sam Cooke's "A Change Is Gonna Come" from Malcolm X.
Yeah,
that whole sequence where you can feel, and again, a very bold choice where Malcolm X is going to his speaking engagement and he knows these could be the last minutes of his life.
Right.
And that's the that's one of the times too. Let me finish. That's one of the times too when his technique that he employs a lot of the actor kind of sitting or standing stable on a dolly, and so there's motion, but the actor himself isn't moving. That the way that's employed in that moment of Malcolm X makes perfect sense because he's reaching that transition period, and then it culminates in the old woman telling him, you know, Jesus is going to protect you, you know.
Yeah.
His films make me weep. Just because they're so compassionate.
By the way, let's not forget She's Got a Habit, which is one of the most incredible debut movies. It's only, I don't know if it's his only black and white movie, but it seems to be that it is, other than his shorts. But
I just like him. I try to go see everything of his in the theater, and I don't always get to, unfortunately. Like something like She Hate Me didn't play that long. I didn't get to see that in the theater. And I'm embarrassed to say I never saw Malcolm X on the big screen, and I always regretted that. I always regret that I never saw that in the theater. But I try to see everything else. And I went to
He said some movies that have disappointed me, no question. I mean, you know, I'm not a big fan of She Hate Me, or even Get on the Bus, which was possibly the most disappointing movie that I've ever seen from him, because I just thought Get on the Bus was just such a great idea for a movie, and I didn't feel that it quite worked, even though it had a great cast and so forth. But I do have an immense affection for Spike Lee. I mean, he's somebody that I've met. He was very, very kind to me. I read his book when I met him, and this was during the school days phase of his career.
Right,
and
right.
I had met him in Atlanta, and he was extremely kind to me, and he knew without actually having to talk to me that I was completely, into what he was doing, and I thought that he, and I was right. He had much promise then, and he's paid off in that promise, tenfold. Mm-hmm. Also, things like we forget about, like Inside Man, for instance, which was another movie of his that I was not prepared to be impressed by. And then it just floored me how great that movie was.
That was incredible.
Entertaining, but just, it just said so much.
Well, and he's veered from the more independent-spirited films to the studio films. Like Inside Man, Malcolm X is an expensive movie, at least in terms of the budgets that he normally has worked with in his career. And then Old Boy, he's doing
Old Boy.
That's
fascinating.
A prospect that really excites me. I love how he's branched out throughout his career. And let's not forget that some of his most powerful work has been in the documentary form.
That's true.
Absolutely.
And I will never, I put on his documentary Four Little Girls, and it just crucifies me, like from mm-hmm. minute one. And there's a moment in that movie where the mother is talking about the last time that she saw her daughter, because mm-hmm. the Four Little Girls became kind of an emblematic of the senselessness of violence during the civil rights era, because they were among the humans that were killed in a church bombing, these four little girls. So one of the mothers that sees her girl off to church, and the last statement that she makes to her little girl is something about pull down your dress, like the hem of her little dress was showing or something. And she, this is 40 whatever years later, and she regrets those being her last words to her daughter. It's such an incredibly touching, unexpected revelation that just hits at home. I mean, you feel the enormous loss in that little unexpected anecdote. And his documentary work is full of that. His Katrina mm-hmm. stuff that he's done, he's brilliant. He's just brilliant.
I love, too, how, let's just face it, that guy is unapologetic for anything he does.
Yeah.
That's what makes him great.
In interviews, in his films, he's absolutely right on a lot of things that he says. Even when he's, he can be insulting to some people, I guess. But, I don't have a problem with
a film director turning around and being insulting to someone who asks an insulting question, not well thought out question.
Right, right.
A question that's loaded with some kind of backhanded criticism in some way. And I've seen his, on the Do the Right Thing, special edition. They've got the whole, Cannes Film Festival question and answer session on that thing. And I'm telling you, he just absolutely is, if he feels like you are not getting it, he will absolutely tell you you are not.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't suffer fools, and that's fine. But he's a filmmaker, and he exists for me because I don't know him personally, just through his films. I mean, that's the only thing that matters to me. And his films are incredibly giving and compassionate, in my opinion.
Something like Miracle of Saint Anna. That doesn't, the first time you see it wasn't that great, but you go back, it's on TV, and I'll watch it, and I'm like, wow, okay, this gets better, on repeated viewings, or something very autobiographical, like Crooklyn, I think is a pretty decent film. And look, I went a couple of weeks ago to see Red Hook Summer, which is not playing anymore, played for a week or two, and I went to see it because I figured, well, this would be the movie that you want to see, because I like Spike Lee. And the movie that's playing next door is like a fearmonger movie, 2016. I'd rather go see the movie that's going to make me feel like inspire me and make me think instead of try to scare me.
Yeah.
I want to see, and that's not like Spike Lee, and that's an interesting film just because he's adapting to the changing technological landscape of filmmaking. And it's interesting. He's making this very, for him, I guess, somewhat experimental. And then he's going to do the studio remake of Old Boy. He's a very fascinating filmmaker.
Here's two other quick things before we close off on Spike Lee. I mean, Summer of Sam I love because it's a serial killer movie that isn't about the serial killer. It's about this community. And I think a lot of people claim that it was, out of all of his films, this is his Scorsese film.
That's a good one, yeah.
You do get a very great sense of that community and how the presence of that serial killer kind of amplifies their paranoia and a lot of hidden prejudices that were there all along.
Right.
And just the editing of it, just the portrayal of the characters, the explicit nature of the sexuality and their attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
If you talk about unapologetic, that really delves in deep.
And that crazy sort of extra saturated photography in that film is just unforgettable.
Absolutely. Yeah, his cinematography is beyond reproach.
Yeah.
All of his films. I mean, his choice of cinematographers. I know that he's worked with, what's his name? The guy that worked with Aronofsky a lot, Matthew Levitan.
Yeah, who is great. And I loved talking to him.
Yeah, he was terrific.
And Ernest Dickerson, of course. Ernest Dickerson, who did
he pulled up Barry Sonnenfeld and started directing his own movies. I mean, he was a great cinematographer, but. Also, the bold choice of using is it Jimmy Breslin in Summer of Sam that kind of narrates the thing?
Yeah,
I just love that. I love that he bookends the movie in a way. It's just incredible. And and I also love, and I've mentioned this on the show before, how he gives his characters room to breathe and just exist and carry on conversations that aren't necessarily integral to the plot.
Right,
right.
They're just there to live with these characters, to live in their world, to hear their views on things and how they interact with others. And I love, you feel like you're getting a full meal in a Spike Lee movie.
There's a great scene in Do the Right Thing I was thinking about the other day, just because I think how it relates to today. The scene where Mookie confronts John Turturro's character and about bigotry, about his racism, he goes, and the thing about pointing out the musicians and the sports figures, he goes, and the difference, well, what the hell is the difference between them and me, or something, and I just thought that was something that you could you could have that conversation today, and it would be completely topical.
Absolutely. It hasn't been. That's a movie. That's, to me, that's his greatest movie, because that movie just seems absolutely ageless. Like, okay, Sunrise is 1989. It absolutely does not look 25 years old.
It's still true.
Well, and a lot of times he'll put these elements in a movie. I mean, She Hate Me is a prime example of these different kinds of plot lines that don't really mesh together.
Right.
He tries to put them together, and I think that's somewhat what he did with Jungle Fever as well. And I don't think I'm alone in thinking the weakest part of Jungle Fever is the Jungle Fever the plot subplot.
Right.
And the most effective element of Jungle Fever is Samuel Jackson's drug addict character.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is such a genuine sense of despair in that storyline, and
mm-hmm.
one of the most devastating scenes I've ever witnessed is when his father shoots him and
yeah.
kills him, and his mother sobbing over his body and saying, "My baby, my baby." Oh.
You know that Samuel L. Jackson is the only person ever in the history of the Cannes Film Festival to win a Supporting Actor Award for that movie.
He deserves it. I mean, honest to God.
Ever given.
Honest to God, that's one of the most devastating scenes I've ever seen.
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, is that the solution to the drug problem? Is that how you solve it? I mean, I always
and above all, for me, I mean, it just speaks to a mother's love.
Yeah.
You know, that you can never shed that away from you. You know, it's always there, and it's desperate, and it's clinging.
Right, right.
But it's always so palpable. It's powerful. I mean, it's just so beautiful. And, oh, my God.
Yes, he's great.
Spike Lee.
Mama, check out this new step. I made this one up just for you.
I paid a lot of money for these, honey. Take them.
Go. I pray for you, my son. Father, I stretch my hands to thee.
Withdraw thyself from me. Oh, whither shall I go?